Hello, this is Pat Lynch,
Kieran O'Keefe,
Brendan Connell,
and this is As the World Turns or Burns. Actually, we should now call it the award-winning As the World Turns or Burns. Jason, fill us in. What award did we win?
We won Best Politics Podcast.
Oh, man. Oh. For the entire state of?
Arkansas.
Oh, man. And you know, and everybody knows Arkansas is the podcasting capital of the U.S., so this is quite an honor.
Yeah. Basically, that's like being number one in the universe at this point.
So. That you took the words right out of my mouth. Yes. So that indeed, three topics today. Kind of get to it. One is pardons. You know, there's been a lot of presidential pardons, and kind of, you know, what's up with that? Second, Venezuela. So a lot of things that are going on there is for saber rattling and whatnot. And then kind of adjacent to Venezuela and kind of related in some ways is war crimes. We're hearing a lot. I think Pete Hegseth was really bugged with all the talk about Epstein, and he decided he wants to own the negative news coverage. So he's got his turn in the barrel, and see where it goes from there. But I'll start off with as far as pardons, and I talked with both you guys about this, that I don't know just the sheer number of pardons that the Trump administration has given so far, but it seems like this is like a, like, and you always use unprecedented, but it's at a rate that is just, to me, is just scary. And it seems like now anything goes, you know, and where it really, my tipping point was, you have the Honduran president convicted 45 years in prison for I don't know how many tons of cocaine he personally was responsible for bringing in. And then it's like, yeah, okay, pardon him. And so kind of the question is kind of, how do we get here? And what are there any limits in terms of how to rein this in? You know, because it seems like it's, you know, completely, to me, in 100% in control of whatever it is Donald Trump wants to do.
I think what makes it unique is how early in his administration he's doing all these pardons. So Obama pardoned a lot more people, but what he did was a lot of it at the very end of his presidency, right, which tends to be the trend. You wait until the end of your second term. Or Trump didn't know he would have a second term, but, you know, typically if presidents win re-election, they wait to the end of the second term, and then they do a bunch of pardons at the very tail end. And Obama's are more about, like, people who are convicted for, like, nonviolent crimes.
And
he's trying to, I guess, do justice to. I mean, how did we get here? I think it goes back to the fact that it's written in the Constitution in a way that is pretty unambiguous. There is very few limitations on the pardon power. The only significant one really is you can't pardon in cases of impeachment. That is a limitation. I think beyond that, any federal crime, at least, is really up for grabs. And I think part of what makes it different than maybe how it was thought about in the late 18th century when it was put into the Constitution is partly just the federal government so much bigger. There's so much more federal legislation than there was in the late 18th century. Late 18th century, most of that would have been at the state level. There weren't really that many federal crimes in the 18th century because the federal government was so much more limited in its scope. And today it's huge. The federal government has a much bigger role, and it gives the pardon power a lot more, I'd say, like, scope than it would have had in the late 18th century. So there's that. I don't really know how you rein it in. I don't know if there really is a way to rein it in, other than maybe an amendment. That would be the clearest way to rein it in. But that any kind of amendment's basically impossible. If you look at, like, what the debates at the time of the founding, the key check that the founders thought there would be on the excessive use or unjust use of the pardon power is that there was impeachment, and that if the president was using the pardon power in a way that was without merit, he could be impeached and removed from office. But that also is broken. The impeachment mechanism, which is actually very central to how the framers thought about checking the power of the executive, is effectively a defunct measure at this point. It doesn't work. But I went there just in preparation for this. I went back and I looked at Hamilton's Federalist paper, Federalist 74, where he laid out his support of the pardon power. And in regards to the origin, I think the idea is good in that, you know, you're going to have cases of injustice. Maybe there's a case where pardoning certain people in times of civil unrest can help quell dissension mm-hmm. by kind of cooling passions. And that is a power that the British monarch traditionally had, the pardon power, which is also limited in cases of impeachment, which is why it's limited that way in the Constitution.
Yeah.
But it's just, it's gone well beyond that. And I was looking back at some of the debates too. This is George Mason, who I knew was one of his reasons for opposing the Constitution because he was an anti-federalist. I knew it was the pardon power, but looking back on it now, I think his quote is kind of prescient. He said this at the debate in Virginia, the ratifying convention in Richmond, where Virginia was debating whether or not to ratify the Constitution. He says, "Now I conceive that the president ought not to have the power of pardoning because he may frequently pardon crimes which were advised by himself. It may happen at some future day that he will establish a monarchy and destroy the republic. If he has the power of granting pardons before indictment or conviction, may he not stop inquiry and prevent detection? The case of treason ought at least to be accepted. This is a weighty objection with me." So some of that has actually seems kind of pertinent to our current situation.
That's kind of scary. I mean, you know, because, you look at, in some ways, are the key players in the Trump administration operating with kind of the thought that they're going to be pardoned? So, you know, we'll talk war crimes. So, you know, here it is, you can blow up boats off of Venezuela, but you can do that knowing that you'll be pardoned. You can deport, Venezuelans on a plane to El Salvador, and you're going to be pardoned. The list goes on. That it's just like it's I don't maybe hyperbole, but it's almost sanctioned lawlessness in some ways. That with the waving of a magic wand, it all goes away.
Yeah, I mean it's a very unchecked power. And there's no, I know you gave me the sheet earlier where it spit out some ideas for how to deal with the problem, but they're all like pretty flawed except for, I think, the constitutional amendment process in terms of actually affecting real change. The amendment process, it's just not going to happen. I think if you were to poll Americans, should the president have the power to pardon? I actually don't know. I don't know how that would poll, because I do think a lot of Americans see it as a vehicle of corruption. This is something that, you know, if you go back to like Bill Clinton pardoned his half brother who had been convicted, I think actually of cocaine charges as well. And then he pardons him at the very end of his presidency. And then I think it was like 5 months later, he was arrested for DUI. So, and then other ideas, you could have the Supreme Court reinterpret how the language, but I think I don't see how that would work because it's so unambiguous. It's pretty clear. That's not going
to
work.
The court, pretty favorable to Trump already, as far as granting him kind of total immunity while in office. So
I can't see them doing that. And then I think the other one, if you got public opinion that opposed how Trump was using the pardon power, that would make a difference. And that could lead to something like impeachment. But again, if you have a polarized, I think so much of the problems just go back to polarization. People are, rigid in their ideology and how they identify. It's just a lot of things don't work the way they're designed.
Well, there was also, is there anything in the Department of Justice where they can put kind of a more transparent or thorough review, review process? Now, everybody will do the eye roll because the Department of Justice is kind of at this stage basically an operating arm of the executive branch anyway. But is the DOJ conceivably could they push back, or is it ultimately that unitary executive and it's if the executive wants this to happen, that end of discussion?
And you could try to put guardrails up by putting like a process in place, maybe review pardons, like maybe you could slow things down a little bit. I don't know, but ultimately, if the president wants to go in there and run roughshod with a pardon power, there aren't any constitutional limitations on it except impeachment. And I think just having – I spent a good amount of time earlier this year reading about the Constitutional Convention, which I hadn't read about it before, but just with all the constitutional issues I've had, I kind of went back and did a deeper dive of it. And it just really stood out to me how much emphasis the framers put on the power of impeachment. That was going to check bad behavior from the president. That was such an important power that could be weaponized. And I think they'd be surprised to see it wasn't weaponized, you know, almost at all in U.S. history, except for, you know, a couple occasions. And that it's just kind of become this defunct power that doesn't really work anymore. I think the only time you could say it really worked was with Nixon, because he got Nixon out with the threat of impeachment.
Right.
But effectively, it doesn't work anymore.
Yeah, tribalism has taken over. And I mean, you can lead an indirectly lead an insurrection, and that's and not get impeached. So it kind of taken everything off the table.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What about I don't want to like veer into the territory. Like, I mean, what I know about the pardon business is everything that Kieran's told me in the past.
Yeah.
But what about like self pardons, like pardoning yourself?
That's what I wanted to bring up.
That's another way I could see this maybe making its way to the Supreme Court if that were to happen. And then I don't know how they would rule. But
well, with Trump's being granted immunity for all actions as the executive, he doesn't need to worry about self pardon because he basically has immunity. Isn't that right?
But can he be charged for stuff beforehand still, before his presidency?
Yes, though I doubt that's what he'd be charged for in this case. I think that Supreme Court ruling it gave him immunity for public actions, but not private actions while he was president. So it wasn't that how, like when Jack Smith is still trying to bring the case after the Supreme Court ruling, he had to kind of reframe it a little bit.
Oh, right. So
it's not 100% absolute. There's a lot of protection, but it's not absolute. So it seemed to me, like just reading on this, that constitutional scholars are kind of split on the issue of self-pardon. Yeah. There's not really a consensus. My feeling would be the Supreme Court might be favorable to that just based on past rulings. But it really comes down to what the Supreme Court wants to interpret, because there is not a consensus by constitutional scholars. Yeah.
You also can't pre-pardon, right? You can't like pardon for stuff that will happen.
Right.
Yeah, you can't do that either. No, that's been shot down.
So does the person like have to be fully convicted, or can like the president shut down something with the pardon? Be like, nope, we're not even going to try this because I'm going to pardon him.
I believe you can pardon if charges have been filed.
Right, but pardon can't be given to impede a congressional investigation. So, you know, like in the case of like Pete Hegseth, he can't give him a pardon now just to ward off any, you know, congressional inquiry into, you know, anything that they've done. So I think that's the one kind of limitation.
Yeah, the behavior has to have happened. You can't pardon for something that didn't happen yet.
Right.
There's no preemptive pardon.
Yeah.
It's such a weird thing to put in the Constitution. Makes you wonder why it's in there. But I think you've told me why it's in there before, which, see if I can get this right. It's just they copied it from kind of existing traditions, and this was something that kings had back in the...
It was a very old power that the English monarch had going back to like the 8th century or something, went back a really long time. And it was just, there were some uses for it. At times the justice system isn't fair, and so the king can step in and give mercy to somebody. And there are times in U.S. history it's been used responsibly. So like during the Whiskey Rebellion, when Washington was president, he just kind of let things cool down. He pardoned the leaders of the Whiskey Rebellion. They were convicted. They were in a lot of trouble, but he pardons them because he thinks it'd be better for the country just to have things cool down. It's very controversial, but you could make the argument that the pardon of Nixon was maybe good for the country not to have that case hanging over the country. So I think the idea is to maybe it provides a little bit of a check on the judiciary, but it also I think the idea was to have somebody there who is well-intentioned, represent of the people, who can look dispassionately at a situation, can pardon somebody who might have been treated poorly, who can use a pardon power to cool passions in times of unrest. That's really the idea behind it. And so if he was responsible, I think there are certain situations where it could be useful. I mean, like Lincoln during the Civil War used a pardon power to try to encourage Confederate deserters, things like that. So there are moments where it's been useful, but overall, I think it's definitely more been more problematic. And as the federal government gets bigger and has a much wider scope, it becomes a bigger issue. But even go back to the colonial period, colonial governors have the power to pardon as well in many cases, usually the limitations on impeachment.
It's interesting, too, that it – so the pardon was put in there at a time where there was de facto or no de facto direct election of the president, which, like makes you wonder now that you have presidents that are de facto at least directly elected, they're obviously very much susceptible to the passions of the people. Mm-hmm. What's to stop them now from using this instrument in a way that is not responsible? So
well, we're seeing that right now.
If you look actually what Hamilton says in his Federalist essay, he says something to the effect of, like, you don't want Congress doing this because, or you don't want a legislature doing it. The legislature can't do it as quickly. They're more deliberative. It takes longer for them to do it. And they also are more likely to be tainted by the passions of the people, more or less. Whereas the president's more likely to be above that in the eyes of how the framers set up the Constitution. That is obviously not how things work, but they definitely didn't get everything right. I think sometimes you get students who are like, the Constitution, you know, is written on, I don't know, immaculate stone. Most of the people were walking on water and nothing's wrong with it. And this is clearly a case where there are some problems with the pardon.
Well,
power.
Everybody's an originalist until you want to get something done that isn't quite match up with the Constitution, and then, you know, all of a sudden now you got some creative revision along the way.
Yeah.
I don't, it's a big issue, but I think the abuse of it, Trump's doing it a lot worse, but I mean, like, I don't know, pardoning Hunter Biden, I didn't really agree with that. Like, Biden had, he's always like, oh, I'm not pardoning my son, I won't do it. And then he did it.
Yeah.
He wasn't very honest about it. And I gave the Clinton example. I don't know.
Oh yeah. Well, let's move on to Venezuela. Game this out. Why is the U.S. doing what the U.S. is doing? You know, we have a MAGA movement that is anti-interventionist. You know, Trump is, I've ended, I don't know, 8 wars, but that, in, you know, now he's doing all the saber rattling off the coast of Venezuela. You know, he's, you know, he's threatening to go, you know, boots on the ground in Venezuela. So what, you know, and why is it that all of a sudden of all the places in the world that Venezuela is kind of where he's pointing his attention?
There's a lot of different theories out there. The least convincing is narco-terrorism. The more you research it, you realize, like, there's not much drug trade that's rooted in, like, Venezuela. Like, you have to kind of look elsewhere. So, like, obviously a lot of cocaine coming out of Colombia. Mm-hmm. Most of the drugs, my understanding, comes up through the Pacific coast through Mexico. So that kind of falls away, and then that makes you kind of scratch your head saying, well, that's being pushed as the narrative, because it is a pretty potent narrative if you want to, you know, garner support for something like as extreme as military intervention or boots in the ground. But then, okay, like what is the true motive behind it? And obviously I don't have the answer to it because I'm not privy to whatever conversations or intelligence, you know, the Department of Defense or sorry, Department of War is, has got nowadays. But, you know, oil is one answer. There's a lot of oil reserves in Venezuela. I think the other one, maybe it's just simply, there's probably a lot of hawkish people within the Department of Defense or within the White House that kind of maybe view this as an opportunity to overthrow someone who is not only a mean dictator, but is kind of in the vicinity or the sphere of influence of Russia and China.
Yeah.
So maybe you've got some people in the ear of the president saying, look, this is an opportunity to do some sort of regime change, and now we're like back to the war on terror almost in the George W. Bush administration. I don't think though that there will be boots on the ground. I do still think that this is some posturing and bargaining tactics that are being done by Trump, just because I think boots on the ground at least would be way too costly and way too controversial. I still think, I know I've said this so many times in the podcast before, but we're still living in like the post George W. Bush era where, you know, we've had the Iraq war, we have the Afghanistan war. I don't think voters and especially Trump's base are going to go with that.
Yeah.
Even if you do try to sell like the narco-terrorism angle. And Venezuela is also not small either. And they have friends. Like there are Russian troops there right now. And they've definitely got Russian weaponry to fight back with. And then if you're talking like boots on the ground too, it's like you have to go into Venezuela on their turf and fight this. Like, how many times have we learned that this is not going to end well for us in the long run? Like, even if you could do regime change, it's not going to end well because what happens after Maduro steps down? So I hope I'm right, at least. Like, I don't think there will be boots in the ground. We could talk about the war crime stuff and the whole thing with the fisherman boat, but I would be very surprised if this escalates further. Now, that said, sometimes one thing leads to another and then you're all of a sudden in a war and it's not your choice. So that would be the fear. But I don't think there's any sincere intention yet by Trump, at least, to send boots in the ground. I think he's doing a little bit of bluffing here. That's my take.
Yeah. And for economic, some kind of economic extraction, because Scott Bessent, his Treasury Secretary, I guess it was a Freudian slip that, you know, he was talking about how gas prices are now, you know, at a, I don't know, 3-year low, or, you know, but, and they'll be even lower once we have access to Venezuelan oil. It's like, whoops, did I really say that? You know, and yeah, they, you know, it tends, you know, the right, it's mercantilism, right? That as far as that Trump's approach to foreign affairs is kind of, you know, from a business angle. And, you know, Ukraine, you know, part of the whole peace plan with Ukraine is just, you know, divvying up all these economic interests. And, you know, and so is there something in all this, you know, this buildup that he has is to, you know, extract whatever economic benefit he can.
Build a new hotel.
Can.
It does always seem like natural resources are at the bottom of every conflict. I mean, obviously that's a generalization, but the more you think about it, there's always some sort of natural resource that's up for grabs. Like you could even make this case for Ukraine, I think.
Oh, definitely. Rare earth minerals, you know, you got the breadbasket of the world, you know, there's a whole bunch.
Kind of funny. When I was in middle school and high school, I remember the idea that, you know, the U.S. went into Iraq for oil was like this sort of like left-wing conspiracy. And now it's like, actually, we're going to Venezuela for oil. So it's just things have...
They're pretty... no noble thing about bringing democracy to the rest of the world.
Trump does not care about like the idealistic foreign policy, the moral foreign policy. It's not something he's interested in. I'm inclined to agree that we won't actually put troops on the ground. My best guess at least is that he's trying to use the threat of troops on the ground to get Maduro to step down.
Right.
That's my guess. I don't know if that will work or not. Venezuela is a pretty big country. It's got to be bigger than Iraq geographically, I would think. Yeah. I don't know population-wise, but it's got to be bigger geographically than Iraq. Americans have no stomach for, regime change wars. I think that's very unlikely. I do think, though, he's probably being influenced by some of the people in his circle who are into this stuff. I'm thinking mainly Marco Rubio, somebody from Florida, hawkish on Cuba, hawkish on any kind of left-wingism in Latin America, which Venezuela is, I guess, kind of socialist, isn't it? In theory, at least.
Yeah.
So
there's a big Venezuelan cohort in Miami, in South Florida, that I'm sure has, Rubio's.
Yeah, influences Rubio a lot. Yeah. So I think Rubio and some of like the, it's weird to think about, but it's really some of like the neocons. I don't think of Trump as a neocon, but some
like
of the neocons.
Lindsey Graham kind of,
someone like that and has have influence over him. And that's where you see a little bit of this diversion within the MAGA coalition where Trump's not a neocon, but he's also not like some of the, he's not like quite like Tucker Carlson either. He's not some of the, who's like fully I think, isolationist in the way that some of the people on the very far right wing of the MAGA coalition would like to be. In some ways, kind of in the middle of it, I feel like. He's kind of like a moderate in the MAGA movement in some respects. So we'll see. This could, I can't imagine that that wing of the MAGA movement would back an invasion of Venezuela. Then they'd be very unpopular.
Yeah, well, we'll see. Third topic, war crimes. Okay, how did we get here? I mean, just going back, why? I understand that the reason as far as blowing up these vessels off the coast of Venezuela, you know, that they were narco terrorists, but there was a war declared. Was that what it was against the cartel? Is that kind of how it all began?
Well, this is one element of it is people say, there's no war that's declared, so you can't do something like this even to begin with. I actually don't like that argument at all, because then what, every single military endeavor has been illegal since World War II, then that would mean for the United States. Like, gone are the days of declaring war. So it's the same thing like over the summer, that strike in Iran, the same thing was being said, and then eventually that died down after a week or two. More what seems to be more like vocal right now is like the war crime element of it. And I don't mean like illegal, like crime of aggression or illegal use of firearms, but like the, like, what's the Latin term for it? Like justice during war versus justice of war, law during war.
Justus belli or something like
that.
There you
go. Yeah. It's been a while since I've taken Latin, meaning never, but,
your priest will forgive you.
it's kind of comical though, because basically the argument that's being said is you can shoot a missile at a fisherman or like a fishing ship.
Yeah.
But then if you don't kill anyone, or if you don't get to kill everyone on it, you can't shoot another missile.
Yeah.
Which really is what the law is. It's like if there's someone who's like unarmed and unable to fight back, you have to basically give them quarter. So that was like what's being argued about, but it is a little bit silly to me in a way. It's like, but we also were responsible for those two poor people that I guess ended up perishing anyway, because we were the ones that blew up the ship.
Sure.
And I would also add that I do feel like we're back in the George W. Bush administration, because I can guarantee you that this is not the only bad thing the US government or the Department of War, or whatever we want to call it, has done. Like, I think this stuff happens on, like, maybe not an everyday basis, but it happens quite frequently. Right. And it just so happens that this one was ended up in the news cycle. So now people are in an uproar about it. But I think this is one of those things that'll die down after a week. I don't think anyone's getting tried of war crimes. Certainly not by an international court, but I don't even think by our own courts.
Really?
Yeah, okay. That's what I believe. I mean, I've lived under this administration now for 10 months.
Yeah,
I know nothing's going to happen. I mean, to my knowledge, there's been no civilian that's ever been tried for war crimes in the United States. Is it going to happen now under this administration? I don't think so.
Hmm. What if there's a blue wave a year from now? That's kind of where I think that, you know, this could change dramatically.
I think it's a president that no one wants to set, because like I said, I think this stuff happens a lot more often than people know, because most of it's not on camera. And when you fight a war, or if we don't want to call it a war, when you're in violent conflict, I think that this happens on the battlefield all the time.
Like that's fog of war kind of sometimes, or not even just that,
but I mean,
I just wanted to kill him.
when you end up in a war, like who knows what happens on the ground? Like, I've never been on the ground, the war in Afghanistan, the war in Iraq.
Yeah.
But you got to think like this stuff happens more than people want to admit. And then, so I think once you open up that box, I think it would make people somewhat fearful of like, oh, well, now we're going to start, you know, putting all these like people in, you know, government, you know, under the microscope, and we're going to start, you know, doing interrogations to see if they're responsible for this war crime when we sent troops to this place or this drone strike. I just don't think anyone wants to open up that, you know, can of worms.
That's what Hegseth is, when he came in, you know, as defense secretary, wasn't that his line? Was that, you know, he wanted warriors and he wanted them not to be bound by, like, all these, I don't know, laws or you know, things that would stop them from their mission, which is like, oh, what's it like? You know, kinetic, like lethal force, you know, that you got to let warriors do what warriors do.
And it's not even a uniquely Hegseth thing.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
It's come from, I'm sure, on both sides of the aisle before. I mean, this is one of the reasons why the United States is not party of the International Criminal Court. And we've, in fact, passed national laws to penalize other countries for joining the International Criminal Court because we want to protect not just our own policymakers from being convicted for whatever war crime, but our soldiers as well. The same sort of logic that I guess Hegseth was saying.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I think it's I really just think this will blow over after like a week or so, and it's just it's in the news cycle right now.
Prediction. I'll follow up as far as blowing over, but do you think Hegseth keeps his job? Because they just came out with the release on the signal gate and everything, and it was pretty harsh in terms of that he just completely ignored all the security, you know, all the proper security, and he, through his lack of using the proper security protocols, technically put troops at risk, you know, for this Yemen strike.
Mm.
So I know Trump's been loath to want to let anybody go and give the libs or the media a win, but you know, is that somebody eventually is going to, you know, that, you know, going to have, you know, have to leave. And do you think he'll be able to weather this?
I would think so.
I think for the time being.
He would have left already, but.
All right. I got to be the contrarian. I no, really. You know, there's just, you can already see, and here's kind of some of the reasons for my thought is, I think, you know, just the way Hegseth handled this recent, you know, where two people were accidentally killed, and he's throwing this Admiral Bradley under the bus, that he's going to lose, you know, his command. You know, he'll lose respect of all the people in the military. That it's just, you know, a military leader, he takes full responsibility. You know, this is my department. I'm the one responsible. Could be that others were involved, but I'm the one who, you know, this was under my command, so I take full responsibility. That's not what he's doing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's conveniently saying, "Oh, yeah, I was out of the room. You know, I was, I was watching Fox News in the other room while, you know, this happened." And then, you know, you think about, you know, he's brings every one of his like leading commanders in to basically tell them that they need to be more in shape and not fat, you know, and, you know, there's, it's a thing, and I see this in the business. I put this like with what happens in the business world where you just lose everybody, you know, that everybody loses respect for you, that then the knives are out, and one mistake, one more slip up, it'll just get amplified, because people really want to, you know, have this guy gone, and you'll start seeing more leaks.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's tried, you know, lie detector. He's so paranoid, which is another sign of a bad leader. You know, one is just, you know, not taking accountability, and the other is just being so paranoid about leaks that it just shows that, you know, there's an insecurity there. And I think it things like this, they build one after another after another. And that some way the military command will get to Trump and just say, you know, find a way, you know, get him find him a broadcasting gig somewhere or some, just find something and just move him out of here.
It could happen. It reminds me, does anyone know here, like, how did this information come to light? I don't think I've ever, like, leak this? Yeah. It was a leak?
Yeah. Washington Post broke the story they had inside sources. Somebody on the inside told the Washington Post, and then they published it. So
I mean, it could already be happening.
That's why I'm saying that this is kind of what happened in Trump 1.0, is so that, you know, at that time he didn't have all the loyalists like he does now, and people just were so concerned and opposed to a lot of things, and the leaks were everywhere. And then, you know, you started to, you know, see that, you know, all of a sudden all this confidence arose. Now, Trump's the chief executive. He you know, they can't necessarily get pushed out. But there's, that's why I just go on record. I think that this is the beginning of the end as far as, you know, Pete Hegseth, you know, in the Department of Defense, that, you know, there's just too much here, and it's one way to make the story go away is, okay, we had kind of command, you know, we had a person in command that really made some critical mistakes. We're learning from it, and we're going to move on.
Mm-hmm. Now, the bigger question is, does Trump really even care, though? Because in a way, you know, it is high on his priority list, but if things keep happening, like if this keeps happening, keeps making news and more people keep like getting, you know, killed on accident, blah, blah, blah. I think that, yeah, that could definitely happen. But like, if it just is like a one-time thing and then people just keep trying to leak small things, is that really going to bother him? Especially considering what's going on right now with him?
The ego and the ego and his determination not to give anybody a win by forcing somebody out, you know, that has limits. You can hang on for just so long to people, but if it continues, that would be one. You know, I think he could blow it off, because, I mean, Stephen Miller, Christy Noem, well, gosh, who's the guy that took $50,000 in a Wawa bag or whatever, you know, that
Holman?
Yeah.
Tom Holman.
But the part that is different here is that the military's got such a strong culture, and military leaders just have a level of respect, you know, that you know, across government, across the, you know, the civilians. And I think he's lost the people that he's leading. And when that happens, it usually leads to some, you know, that they'll find a way to kind of help him find his next opportunity and spend more time with his family, as the press release always says.
Seems to me they've been trying to purge the military to some degree, though, like getting rid of some of these.
Yeah.
You know, had
JAGs are gone. You know, yeah. But, you know, you're going up against such a strong culture, and you start trying to mess with that. You know, now I could go full conspiracy in that it could lead to a coup. it's just that that's one of the strongest cultures in Washington, is that, you know, the Pentagon and I think he's lost him. I won't even say losing him, that there's going to be more that is just going to keep amplifying. One person's opinion.
Yeah. We'll see. It's kind of related, but I think within the military, there's kind of a divide. This is just anecdotal evidence, I guess, I'm basing this on. But it seems to me that the officers, people who went to West Point, people who went to Naval Academy in Annapolis, they mostly are not, like, MAGA people.
Right.
But I think you get to, like, the non-officer ranks, the enlisted soldiers, or the Navy, Air Force men, Air Force women, I think there's more MAGA support in the enlisted ranks than there is among the equivalent civilian population.
Right.
That's my sense of it. I think there's kind of like a divide between the officers, which I guess the officers are the ones who are, you know, in DC and involved in all this. But I do think there's kind of a division within the ranks of the military.
Yeah. Well, you know, we'll see. You know,
we got the receipts now.
Yeah. I mean, I'm you know, I'm not doing too well. I predicted the Lions were going to go undefeated for the season. And
to be fair, I think you did predict the government shutdown, though, which was a big win for you.
Yeah.
You've been riding that coattail for a little bit.
That's why producer Jason's my guy. Came in and rescued me. But
that's why they call him the Podfather, too.
Yes, the Podfather.
Podfather and, Jr.
And it's still our predictor in chief is Brendan with the predicting Trump. That you know that
was like add up all of our good predictions. We're actually quite marvelous. We're quite impressive.
Yes,
ignore the bad ones.
Yes, well, we always do. You know that why get held up by that? All right, any closing remarks, award winning podcasters, before we go?
Well, I did wonder who did we beat.
Oh,
what were the other podcasts in Arkansas? Podcast? Yeah,
I don't remember the list. There was like three or four channels.
Yeah,
were all the same ones that won. Whatever one won best government was also on best politics, and they lost best politics.
Yeah.
So which one's cooler, best government or best politics?
Politics all the way.
Easy, right?
Yeah.
Who cares about the government?
And at least for best, for like the. I guess best male and best female hosted podcast where we won, and those lovely kids from Tiger Talk didn't win. Didn't beat us this time. You know,
they made
love them.
Well, here's why: they made categories directly for them.
I know.
And we're not. This isn't Yaptopia. Oh,
yeah.
So, you know,
yeah, we would have been crushed if it was just I told you guys Jason saw it. These two adorable 12-year-olds had from an elementary school have this thing called Tiger Talk and they had the best acceptance speech. Oh my gosh, you know, and they're it's not just that they thank and you know they thank all the people that helped them, and then they wanted to thank all the people here for all the hard work that they did. I mean, it was
they were like, congratulations to all the other winners, and we're like, oh damn it.
Yeah, I know. They're making us look petty and damn 12-year-olds. And
I know.
And then at the end, they always wrap it up. Tiger Talk to you later. Growl. Oh, gosh. You know, I mean, I would have voted for him. I mean, it's.
Did you give an acceptance speech?
Yeah, it was awful.
I had to give a bunch. It was.
What'd you say?
If you go on the line.
I took full credit. It was all my idea.
good.
No, I thank you both.
Mm-hmm. On the video. We vlogged the whole thing.
Yeah, I sent you an email that night, and then you guys were super excited. I never heard from you. It's like I'm on Thanksgiving break later. It was like,
No, but yeah, we had to go up and accept some awards, and it was kind of funny because I had to accept a bunch because they psyched Hannah and Kari weren't here either, so I had to go up there for them, and I had to go up there for Cheyenne, and then I had to go up there for the studio as well, and the people are just getting so tired of seeing me.
The guy next to me goes, "Oh, that guy."
Yeah. The guy.
Yeah, Jason represented all females from Lion College.
Yeah, I know. It was like best. It was so awkward because it's like best female hosted podcast, and here comes
you went up,
and I was like, everybody's like, "Oh, what the heck?" And he's like, "You're not Hannah or Kari, are you?" And I'm like, "Nope."
No, not today.
No. And then I had to make a joke to save it.
Yeah.
The joke didn't land.
Is this Fayetteville? Where was?
Yes.
Or, okay.
Yes. So it all ended well.
Mm-hmm.
Do we need create our own little Tiger Talk to you later kind of closing, you know, or?
I don't know what you would do.
I know. We'll shelf that.
Yeah, I think we're okay without it.
Yeah. As the world turns or burns, we could like light a couch on fire or something.
Oh, man.
Throw it off the roof with Doyle rules. Yeah.
All right. Oh, we're...
We'll have to get lighters.
Oh, yeah. That, well, that was actually Radix. I think that was one of his ideas with the... Of, the Lion football team.
No, won. No. It wasn't light a couch on fire. It was that was a different thing.
Yeah, what were we? So we were going to light a couch on fire for something.
Well, he wanted like throw it off the top of the Lion building for.
This, okay.
Okay. But the thing for the football was if we won the very first game at our home game,
oh, right.
Shulga wanted everybody to rush the field and take the one of the goalposts and go put it in the Bryan Lake. And just throw it in there.
You can't do that.
We didn't win. So.
Well, we didn't win, so it didn't
matter. But wouldn't it be epic, you know, just seeing like you know, like the, maybe the top part of the goalpost sitting in the lake forever?
It would be epic, yeah. But, I'm, you know, there's someone who would be like shivering, would be like, how are we going to pay for this again? You know?
Yeah. It was a joke. But the burning couch was about something. I don't remember. It was a thing. I can't remember.
Sense at the time.
But yeah, it was like throwing it out of the. No, it was because we needed to get rid of your couch in your office, and we were like, well, what if we just like make it an accident? It's burning, and we throw it out the window or something like that.
No, there was something about there was going to be a reason to sacrifice a couch, and yeah, then I had to make sure it wasn't mine. You know, we actually was going to be the one over here. And, yeah. Oh well, enough on arson. I think.
Yeah,
and since it's as the world turns or burns, you know, I guess it's a good way to end it.
Yeah, yeah, I like Connell's idea of like taking the lighters and being like, and it goes dark.
Yeah, but, yeah.
Sprinkler system. One more thing,
smokers in here though. We gotta go buy.
How about your Patriots? I know I said this.
They look good. They look good. Yeah.
You excited? Are you getting ready for the season?
I'll be honest. I've not watched much football this year, but I will bandwagon in the end.
Yeah. Oh yeah, best team in football right now.
Yeah, they were ranked number one by every major. Sports network, so
indeed.
Yeah.
Drake May looks good.
The second coming.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yes, the next Tom Brady. Because we always gotta compare him with Tom Brady.
Yeah.
Seven rings incoming.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I think we'll wrap up at this point. Thank you all for listening and watching As the World Turns or Burns. Please subscribe if you haven't already. And also just recommend it to a friend. You know, we'd love to build an audience and just keep doing what we're doing. So we will be back with you in 2 weeks, and there'll be a few things going on between now and then, I'm pretty sure. So I'll say goodbye.
See you
later.
All right. Yeah, take care.
This podcast is sponsored in part by Lion College and Kilt Studios. Thank you to Jonah Winter for the intro and outro music.